Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Welcome, everyone, to another edition of Mormon Matters. This is your host, Dan Weatherspoon, and we are right in the pocket here of the origins of Mormon Matters, which is let's take things that are happening right around us in the church and discuss them in depth. A lot of times we'll do that, but other times we'll just take topics that are of broader interest if there's nothing new happening in the news and things, but that is not the case here today.
We are recording this on Monday night, the 9th of December.
And just last Friday, on the 6th of December, the church's website, LDS.org, in its teaching section, and then from teachings you go to gospel topics, there's a new statement. It's on race and the priesthood is what the title they've given it. And it has kind of hit the bloggernacle with a storm. I kind of asked around at church on Sunday. Nobody had really, except for me, had even heard of it. So I'm sure that this just the groundswell will build. The Salt Lake Tribune had a link to it. I know that other news sources are starting to link and talk about it. So it's right now fresh. And we have three great panelists to help discuss this, help us frame it, help us think through the implications and all those good things. And so I'm thrilled to have back with us one of the favorites. Everyone always writes me. They love it when she's on. Gina Colvin from New Zealand on us again. It's the next day for her, so I shouldn't have said Friday here. It would have been Saturday for you guys when that announcement came out.
That's right. I was in the swimming pool.
Oh, man.
When I found out, yeah.
So, like, how does that happen that you're in a swimming pool and people tell you? Does somebody came up to you?
Oh, no. I was sunbathing and now Jared Tummies messaged me on Facebook, so.
Oh, cool. Well, tell us a little bit about your background.
Well, thanks very much, Dan. Lovely to be back on Mormon Matters. As Dan said, I'm Gina Colvin. I'm a lifelong member of the church. I have Māori and non-Māori ancestry, European ancestry. I work at the University of Canterbury and the College of Education as a lecturer, mostly dealing with race studies, cultural studies, or critical cultural studies. I did my PhD in journalism, which was more of a discourse and analysis. I have a blog called Kiwi Mormon, and really, really interested in being part of this discussion today.
Thank you so much. Yeah, you hit all the highlights that I definitely wanted to have you bring out. And again, just always love your perspectives and your blog. You did a blog post on this too, and so I'm sure you'll be referring to that, and we'll certainly link to it. Margaret Blair Young, thanks for joining us again. You've been on a couple of times, and this time I guess we did have you once in your wheelhouse a little bit as you reflected upon the passing of Marion D. Hanks and those things. Another time was just more on parenting and proactiveness, and especially in sexual education and things like this. This time it's in one of your main scholarly interests, which is, you know, Black studies and the history of Blacks within the church. But give us a quick rundown on what you do for a living and some of the projects that are related to this.
I am Margaret Blair Young. I teach English at BYU part-time. I've been in race studies just on my own with Darius Gray for about 15 years. We've done 3 books, 3 documentaries, and a bunch of articles on biographies and encyclopedia articles on Black pioneers, the race issue itself. And the statement was really significant. I can't overstate its significance for us.
Awesome. Well, we'll get a feel for that and your sense of why you make that claim here as we go. But thank you. Yeah, so the film Nobody Knows is probably your most famous of the films, right, that you've done so far. I know you're doing one now on Africa.
Art of Africa. That we assume that will become more famous than Nobody Knows.
Okay, good. Good. And so that's working. And are you in pre-production now or actual filming?
We're still in the part that the worst part of any filmmaking, which is getting the money together.
Yeah.
But it's coming. It's coming actually quite well.
Well, good. Feel free to send me a link and I'll post it to how anybody can get involved.
Better.
Okay, thanks. Well, again, thank you for being on again. Janon Graham, welcome to the podcast for the first time. Please tell us about yourself.
Thank you. I'm so excited to take part in this discussion with you all. I am actually a convert to the church. I converted about 3 years ago. My main focus in my undergrad, I did my undergrad at Purdue, and it was more visual communications focused. But over the past couple of years since I've graduated, I've kind of shifted my studies to feminist and womanist studies. Particularly within the church, I focus on Africana gender studies. Currently, I'm applying to grad school, hopefully cross my fingers, for women's studies, where I would focus on Black feminist and womanist theology in Mormonism.
Awesome. And you're in the Washington, D.C. area?
I am. Yes, I am.
And I guess, are you part of one of those famous downtown D.C. wards with the great diversity and stuff? Or what's your church experience like?
My church experience, there's about 200 plus people. There aren't many people of color in the church, in my particular ward. In D.C. 3rd, it's pretty diverse, but in my particular ward, it is not.
Okay, so you're a trailblazer of some sort. And have people come up to you since the announcement? Did you have a good Sunday talking about these things?
Actually, I didn't have any discussions about the announcement. The discussions that I've been having have been taking place mostly online. So.
Okay, well, I'm sure that will change
as
the word gets out and stuff like that. All right, well, welcome to the show, and I'm sure other pieces of your autobiography will unfold, as it will with all of us, as we start talking about this. So let's get started, you guys. I'd love us to just quickly, for those who haven't read the statement, to go over the different things that are there. Margaret, would you lead us a little bit? You know, you can editorialize a little bit here, but let's just make this primarily informational. And Gina and John, as you hear her talk a little bit about this stuff, feel free to add your own, you know, coloring or here's how this reads to me or something. But let's just kind of at least do an informational section here for the first 10 minutes or so.
So it begins with talking about how the church in its structure and organization, if not in practice right now, because we are predominantly white. But it talks about the structure being able to support complete integration, that we can have a Black bishop presiding over a predominantly white congregation. I have seen a number of Black bishops. Their congregations tend to be diverse. Bishop Jermaine Sullivan does a marvelous work. Well, he's now a state president in Atlanta, and the ward, I'd say, is 50-50. So after that, it goes into the history of the race issue, being the church being established in 1830, and for any historians, they would recognize that that's right at the point of the igniting of a lot of the racial furor in the country, because 1831 is the Nat Turner Rebellion. And then, of course, we move into right when the church is being organized. We've got things going on like obviously the Civil War, but the Fugitive Slave Act. Anyway, so then after, it mentions that Joseph Smith opposed slavery, which is significant. That's actually in the Doctrine and Covenants, and does mention that Joseph Smith ordained Black men. It specifies Elijah Abel, does not specify Walker Lewis, who I think is particularly important because Brigham Young alluded to Walker Lewis in 1847 and said, we have one of the best elders, an African, in Lowell, Massachusetts. So clearly he was aware of Walker Lewis, aware that he had the priesthood, and referred to him without any kind of indication that there was a problem with that. But in 1852, and I'm adding a little context here, everybody has come to Utah, or they soon will. The majority are there now. The handcart pioneers will be coming later. But the Southerners have come and brought their slaves. 1850, we have the California Compromise. Utah is given the option by popular sovereignty to choose either being a slave state or not, and chooses to be slave carrying, or carrying those in servitude. They tended to use servitude rather than slavery as a semantic difference. And then again, goes over more of the history of this, you know, where it was established, and then talks specifically about the most prominent justification for the priesthood restriction, the idea of the blacks being descendants of Cain, and the understanding that Cain had been given a mark which had been interpreted as black skin. This was actually, and it's mentioned in the article, black servitude was sometimes viewed as a second curse placed upon Noah's grandson Canaan. This was a justification for slavery. So not specifically for a priesthood restriction, but in retrospect, it was used. Converts at that time would all have believed in the curse of Cain / Canaan. That was part of the culture. 15th century, the curse of Cain was cited as a justification for enslaving Africans. And then in 1852, we have Brigham Young giving his tuck to the Utah legislature. He's the governor, but he's also the president of the church. There's one tiny little error here. It says that Elijah Abel petitioned to receive his temple endowment in 1879. He actually petitioned earlier than that as well. But the 1879 one is really significant. Brigham Young had died in 1877, and Brigham Young had turned Elijah Abel down, though Elijah Abel had been washed and anointed in the Kirtland Temple and had not been endowed because he had moved from Nauvoo in 1841 before the Nauvoo Temple was there. So 1879, Brigham Young is dead. Elijah Abel petitions for his temple endowment, and they have a big discussion, ultimately saying, does he hold the priesthood? And eventually they decided that he would still retain his priesthood, but would not be able to be endowed. Jane Manning James crossed the plains and lived in Salt Lake City until her death. She also asked for her temple ordinances, was allowed to do baptism for her ancestors, not allowed to participate in her ordinances, and the curse of Cain was put forward as a justification. It specifically, Wilford Woodruff talked to Jane and blessed her for her faithfulness, but then put in his journal that it was because of Cain that she was not allowed to. Jane had a remarkable sense of what the gospel meant, and I'll be happy to talk about that later on. And then goes to David O. McKay. It's, of course, there's not time in the statement as it is to go over all the details, but in 1925, David O. McKay really wasn't aware of a priesthood restriction. It wasn't a front burner issue, but he did, of course, become aware. And then in the 40s and 50s, he was erasing priesthood restrictions from a lot of people in various places, including Fiji, the Australian Aborigines, in South Africa, actually Monroe McKay. Had served a mission and then went to David O. McKay and said, you've got to go to South Africa. And David O. McKay said, well, you're the first person I'll tell this to, but I'm going. And went and saw the problems, because when people were asked to trace their lineage to show that they didn't have African lineage, black African lineage, they wouldn't do it, because most realized that African lineage was going to show up. We now know that it would show up for all of us, you know, our DNA.
Right, when you go back to the...
So then we've got the history through David O. McKay, and it's sort of in Utah, it's not front burner, because we just don't have many blacks at all during this era. We do have some of the descendants of the pioneers, but very, very few. It doesn't become a real issue until the civil rights, and then Brazil, with the problem of the mixed race people there, and President Kimball becoming very aware and loving Helvecchio Martins, and becoming aware of the real problem there, where they had a sixth discussion if they realized that the person was black, but meaning of African lineage. So it does talk about Brigham Young and his saying, in the midst of some very ugly and racist things, he did say that someday blacks would hold all of the blessings of the priesthood that anybody else has. And then President Kimball, after much prayer and consideration, and also reading Lester Bush's remarkable article published in Dialogue and underlining it, that was an important thing. And we have to remember that education is part of revelation.
Right.
So it doesn't stand alone, but it brings us to the point where we may start asking questions that haven't occurred to us to ask before.
Right. Now you're leaving the document here with a lot of this extra stuff. So it does talk definitely about many hours of prayer and study for President Kimball here, and they do link in this thing to Ed Kimball's wonderful article in BYU Studies, that if you really want to be moved by how hard he worked to get this revelation and to bring it forth at a time when he felt like the brethren would accept it, the church would accept it, that he was free from all the prejudice and stuff himself, that's a very, very powerful thing. But yeah, so the Lester Bush thing isn't mentioned here, but it definitely talks about, you know, the the changes that are coming at Civil Rights Movement, the Sao Paulo, Brazil Temple, and then we do have some statements.
Can I do the most important part? And I promise not to go off on tangent. It's hard for me to read through this and not editorialize.
Go for it.
And I'll just turn time over to the others for a little bit and be quiet. So it says, today the church disavows the theories advanced in the past that black skin is a sign of divine disfavor or curse, or that it reflects actions in a premortal life, that mixed race marriages are a sin, or that blacks or people of any other race or ethnicity are inferior in any way to anyone else. Church leaders unequivocally condemn all racism, past and present, in any form, and then repeats what it had said in the beginning. The Lord denieth none that come unto him, black and white, bond and free, male and female. All are alike unto God, both Jew and Gentile.
Yeah, it bookends with that. Right at the very beginning, it leads off with the as the Book of Mormon puts it, all are alike unto God, and then it ends there as well. So that's wonderful. And then Gina, you were on the discussion where we talked about the new intros to the scriptures, and we did official declaration too. Am I remembering right that that's how that one now reads too? It leads with that statement.
Do you know, I can't remember. I think so, Dan. I think you're right.
I think so. I meant to look it up in prep, but I forgot. But yeah, I think it all leads with the scriptural justification right here, or not justification, but just the pronouncement that all of us, I think, who listen to this podcast and things like this, know in our hearts and our guts. But sometimes it just needs to be said, and it's nice that they bookmark it there. Well, thanks, Margaret, for that. Yeah, those are kind of the key things, and definitely those different things at the end, the curse of Cain, the renunciation with earlier within it of the Canaan stuff, the premortal life, the mixed race marriage problems that people would have, that there's anything to do with skin color in Lord's favor. Gone, 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 gone. Renounced, renounced, renounced. So much, much to celebrate there. Gina and Janan, what else is in the statement itself that caught your eye that maybe you'd want to echo or amplify or add in?
Something that really stood out to me was the acknowledgement that it wasn't just a priesthood ban, that it was also a priesthood and temple ban. I think in previous years, they've kind of left that out. If you listen to like Elder Dixon's talk from an earlier conference, I mean, any conference talk or lesson, it's always referred to a priesthood ban. So I think that was very important, especially for black women historically who have been marginalized within even the category of women who are already marginalized. So that was something that was very important for me personally.
Excellent.
And anything else, Janan, for you that was there? Just to raise up at this point, we'll obviously discuss it all.
I'm curious to hear what everyone thinks about the use of the word theory as opposed to teachings. I think theories, they talk about the teachings being theories. And I just had some, I guess, questions, or I just wanted to see what you everyone thought about that.
Now, are you thinking the justifications, the theories, those as theories, or what? Where is the use of the word theory in here without me doing a quick search?
So Margaret actually read the paragraphs of today, the church disavows the theories advanced in the past that black skin is a sign of divine disfavor or curse.
So the justifications are the
yes.
theories. Yeah, okay.
Absolutely.
Good. Okay. Good. So yeah, what do you guys think about that? There's terms that come with the ban that we'll often hear, policy and doctrine, and now we're adding the word theory in here, you know, as a thing. So what do you guys think of how it handles, you know, those justifications? The post hoc explanations for why we're not opening the priesthood and the temple to everyone.
I think there's a way in which the piece, although I find it really liberating, uses language in a way in which the church becomes subject to the prevailing ideologies of the time. And this way of using other languages, other nouns like policies and doctrines and theologies, kind of softens, I think, I agree with Janan, it softens this notion of it actually being a declared revelation that is actually deeply embedded in a sense of LDS doctrine. And it's you know, for me, I find it a little bit of a deflection from the discursive work that was going on at the time to position blacks and those seen not necessarily eligible for the priesthood.
Janan, is that what you were kind of wondering? Did she hit on at least the area you wanted to talk about?
Yeah, absolutely. I was a little put off by the use of some of the terms that were used in the publication, because at the end of the day, these were things that were taught as, I mean, they weren't declared doctrine, but people thought of them as doctrine, that Black people were less valiant, that Black people were descendants of Cain. So I would hope that hopefully in the future there's some clarification on that. But as it stands now, I don't feel comfortable with the usage of theory as it's been used.
Awesome. Now, Gina, you had strengthened that by actually using the word revelation in terms of this. What revelation are you thinking of? Or are you just thinking of, you know, the 1949 statement and others that are just pretty much, this is it, this is the way it is?
Yeah, I am. And I mean, you kind of like cumulatively, you look at all of these statements that are made. I mean, what is doctrine? What is revelation? And I think Brigham Young was particularly vociferous and kind of declaring in the name of God that these particular racial doctrines were, came from God.
But he never claimed to have gone to God to seek an answer to this. He was just, you know, first of all, the main ones that they're talking about here are, you know, not in his capacity as prophet, but as the territorial governor. But then obviously he did teach Curse of Cain and things like this. But did he ever like strengthen that by like, I have found out for myself that this is the truth?
Well, he does say something in the name of God, doesn't he? I'm just looking for it. When he talked about the seed of Cain having relations with white folk having relations with the seed of Cain, that they would be struck down or something. Didn't he say something about that?
Yeah, well, and I can see that, but it's still, but, you know, he. Oh, go ahead, Margaret, please.
The consequence would be death on the spot, is what he said.
Right, but he didn't say, I got this through revelation. He just, this was just a declarative rhetoric of a guy that liked to declare a lot of things.
he claims that it's a divine decree, yes. Brigham Young said, if no other prophet has said it before I say it, the seed of Cain has no right to the priesthood. And as Armin Moss, who is one of our great scholars of the race issue, as he said, that's Brigham Young kind of on his own lights, declaring himself as the prophet who will state what Joseph Smith did not, that those who he interpreted of African descent, he labeled them the seed of Cain, had no right to the priesthood. Then in 1879, when Elijah Abel petitions again for his endowment, petitions to John Taylor, the new president, the question is not what did Brigham Young say about this, but what did Joseph Smith say about it? And Zebedee Coltrane and Abraham Smoot are asked. Zebedee Coltrane says that he's positive that Joseph Smith said to him that he kind of dropped his head and said, the Spirit says that what Brother Zebedee says is right. The Black man cannot have the priesthood. But then Zebedee Coltrane goes on to say, Elijah Abel, when his race was discovered, was dropped from the quorum. And that is countered by Joseph F. Smith, who brings two certificates of recertification for Elijah Abel, showing that that is simply wrong. So that 1879 meeting ends with Elijah Abel not being allowed to have his endowment, but retaining his priesthood still being recognized. And then his son and grandson were also ordained to the priesthood.
Interesting. That's good to have the background, but Janan, you were sort of like, you just wanted to make sure that, you know, yes, you're, maybe we can turn in a second to how we all feel about this statement. One of your slight hesitations, it didn't sound super overwhelming for me, but you can correct me, is that just, let's not mince words, this was the teaching. There was 100 years at least of this being pretty much the rhetoric of the church as well as the policies. And, it, you know, what can be more strong than what's preached over the pulpit, what's written in books, right? That kind of thing.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there was a whole book, Mormonism and the Negro, that talked about the policy towards Black people. So I think there needs to be, I would hope that there's a discussion on it. It's not just, this is what was taught. this wasn't, although it wasn't doctrine, it was a policy that existed for many years.
Awesome.
I promise to not keep interrupting, but what Janan said is really important with John Stewart's book, Mormonism and the Negro, and there's another one by Lund. But because a Nigerian man read that book and realized that this priesthood restriction was a part of the Mormon church. And the there were maybe 20,000 Nigerians, we don't have an exact number, who had wanted to join the Mormon church. They had found materials and had been converted and wanted to join. And when Chukwu Mborja, I can't remember his name, but as he found the book that Janan just alluded to, he made it public and wrote an editorial on a Nigerian paper, and it resulted in people who had wanted to set up missionary efforts in Nigeria being denied visas. So the global significance of that book is huge.
Thanks. Now, let me ask a question. No one knows who authored this statement. It's on LDS.org, so we know that it had to somewhere get blessed along the way by the prophet and the first presidency and the quorum and all those different things. We don't know who authored this. Do you sense, and you know, this might be in your wheelhouse again, Margaret, I know you're hesitant to feel like you're dominating here, but do you sense that everyone really knows the extent to which it was taught from the pulpits and things like that? Or is this deliberate? Is this like a committee's sort of document that, well, I'll pass off on this if it says theories versus teachings, but you know, can you sort of see that sort of give and take going on here that you sort of always get when you have a committee that authors something? That's how it strikes me. I think there's probably a lack of education among some of them. They certainly know a lot, but I don't know if they sometimes pause to think about the significance. Or on the other hand, I'm sure there were people that were slightly more hesitant to release this in what could have been stronger language. Is that what you would guess, Janan or Gina?
I'm not sure how it works in terms of making statements. I know that they have some outside consultancy. I don't, you know, like I think the fact that we don't know about the authorship of this or the context in which it was produced, it makes it very difficult. For instance, I was in my gospel doctrine class, and everyone is two classes short for the year, so I thought, well, this is a good opportunity to talk about this statement. And one woman put up her hand after we read it together as a class, and she said, "But who wrote it?" And everybody's chimed in. They said, well, it's on the LDS.org website. And her response was, but who wrote it? Did the first presidency sign it off? Does the Quorum of 12 approve of it? Who wrote this? And from that, we really just, you know, the assumption is that anything that goes on to LDS.org is sanctioned by the first presidency. I don't know. I don't know how to make sense of these things that appear, because of course they're not very transparent about the kind of workings and thinking that they do.
Well, I imagine it would be from church historians. I mean, how long ago did they release about the first vision?
Yeah, a month or two ago, right?
A month or two ago. Okay, so it seems like it's pretty up in the air, and there wasn't even a date with its release, so
right.
it's almost as if it's always been there, and
yeah.
Those of us who study and who keep on top of it know that that isn't the case.
Yeah, it is interesting. At the end of it, after the footnotes, it says the church acknowledges the contributions of historians and scholars to the historical context set forth in this article, whose contributions are used with their permission. So it does acknowledge that they consulted things, but it does say here the church acknowledges, meaning the church, you know, stands by this. But I think all of your and especially Gina, that's very poignant what the woman in your class said. I think that is there. But in 1978. Obviously, the thing came out with the first presidency's signature. I know they sent out letters to the presidents and all this stuff. Here, it's like what you just said to Janan a little bit about, it just shows up. There's no date on it. There's no really big announcement. It's kind of grouped in with things like the first vision accounts, you know, context that they're given. So in some ways, this is definitely not a big news cycle thing. In fact, even bringing it out on a Friday, in some ways, someone might declare as a sort of a way of hiding it. Thoughts?
Yeah, I don't know necessarily hiding it. I think it'll be interesting because I'm sure missionaries will have investigators who are asking questions about the priesthood temple ban, and they'll be directed to this page. I guess that's my concern, that just kind of going back to what I was saying before, it's everything that was said in on that page, it's not... It, that always hasn't been the case. And so I don't want, I don't want to use the term whitewashing history.
Ah, there you go. pejorative but, use of white or lightness instead of darkness, right? That's the opposite of what we usually get.
Yes. I do think it was downplayed. Usually, I was surprised it didn't come out in the newsroom or just an official church announcement, right. Even being read over the pulpit. So it just kind of slipped in.
Yeah. And Margaret, when you were looking for it, it was pretty hard to actually find it on the church's website, right?
It was hard to find. But because it is so hard to find, it is up to the rest of us to be the messengers. A little message that has huge implications. And for those of us who have been working with this issue for a long time, this goes so much further than anything has ever gone in the past. We are thrilled with it. You know, there are a number of us who've been in on some discussions, who've been deeply concerned with the fact that we lose so many converts of color, that people get baptized and find out what was taught previously. For us, this is just the most liberating thing that we now have this document that we can talk about. And I see no need to go into all of the ugly things that Brigham Young said or anybody else. It's certainly not difficult to find them. But this gives us an opportunity to repent, to say it is so explicit there. This was not right. It doesn't come right out and say it wasn't right. It doesn't offer an apology. The idea of offering apologies is kind of a new thing to me. I see people asking for apologies a lot. But it talks about what we do not support. We have never, ever had an official church document that says, this is not correct. The curse of Cain is wrong. The idea that blacks were less valiant in the pre-existence is wrong. This document hits both of those. Nothing in the past has done it.
And we still probably have some mixed race marriage frowning right. upon and things like that. So it's nice to talk about that. And,
absolutely.
You know, one of the extensions to me, we won't raise it in this podcast, but, you know, the whole dark skin stuff in the Book of Mormon to me is much more about, you know, marrying within the faith and the traditions and just the skin color being the natural result of mixing with native persons, you know, in there. And it was really never like an overnight their skin was darkened kind of thing. And so maybe this will open up the discussion for that down the road. So I'm thrilled with those two. So it's basically the specificity that you can now point out, Margaret. I know online you've been telling everybody, laminate this, carry it around with you. Whenever it comes up, you're able to at least read this one paragraph to them, right?
Oh, and I send it. I write to missionaries. I have a number of missionaries I'm writing to who are in predominantly black areas. They have that on their dear elder letters that are coming to them. They've got it.
Nice. Okay, Gina, you had a lot of critiques of this, so. Let me do this, though. Janan, you've also been a little bit hesitant on the word theory and things like that, and a little bit that this is downplayed. Margaret gave a very enthusiastic, this is wonderful, we now have it. What's your assessment? Would you say you're thrilled as well, or where do you fall in the spectrum? And then we'll let Gina with some of her things that she brought up in her blog post, and we'll give those voice.
I am very excited that the announcement was made. I think it's an issue that has kind of sat at the surface for a very long time. I think the ball definitely started to roll when during President Ugdorf's talk this past conference.
Now wait. Okay, Philip, finish that thought. It began to roll because of what did he specifically say? He didn't say anything about race, but what did he say that you're thinking of?
Yeah. He admitted that there may have been mistakes made in the past, if that's...
I think he didn't say maybe. Yeah. He says there were mistakes
made.
And church leaders made them. And, okay. So, yeah, I was wondering if that was, you know, he had some sense that this document was in the works and all that stuff and in some ways that he was preparing it. So it sounds like you think in some ways he was helping prepare the ground for this.
I definitely think so. So, like I said, I feel like it's a great step forward in terms of an apology. I think we belong to a faith that promotes accountability and repentance when wrongs have been done. So in terms of an apology, while I don't demand an apology, but I would hope to see one in the future. And I think that this document is kind of the first step in that process.
Good. Any more you want to say right now? Because we'll have Gina probably say it a little more blatantly. Gina, put it to you there. But so you can either jump in more. Is there another, any initial other framing that you'd want to give it, Janon?
I think I'm going to save it for the end.
Okay.
And talking about racism and things like that. So.
Okay. Good. All right. Gina, however you want to do it, you wrote a blog post. You gave three areas that, you know, this falls short. You said at the end that you didn't want to mitigate, that this was a good thing. You're glad for this document out here. But do you want to go ahead and either, you know, kind of go through your blog post or just however, what main points would you want to make in terms of an assessment of this?
Well, I think taken together, it's interesting because the week before this came out, I think it was not this past Sunday, but the Sunday before, I was asked to give a sacrament talk on Official Declaration 2. And it was quite interesting because I'd kind of cobbled together like Jeffrey Holland's statement, PBS statement, in which he said, taken together, something like, all I can say is however well-intended the explanations were, talking about racial theories, I think almost all of them were inadequate and or wrong. And then the 2012 newsroom statement, Race and the Church, All Are Alike Unto God. And then the changes to Official Declaration 2, the chapter heading for Official Declaration 2. If you put it all together, this document, Race and the Priesthood, seems to sit behind it, gives it the historical context.
Okay.
So I'd already given a speech condemning these things that had happened in the past. Quite interesting, actually, because I didn't, you know, I talked about the role of George Q. Cannon and Brigham Young and Marky Peterson and all of these speculative theologies, and then ended with the idea that if you've got these sort of racist barnacles that, you know, cling to the hull of your church boat, it's time to get them off. So I was kind of thrilled to have that backed up in the statement that came out from the church. However, the interesting thing was that the stake president was in attendance and he was somewhat rattled by it. Whereas there were a number of people in the congregation, including the missionaries and less active folk who had just come back to church and investigators who were thrilled with it. So there's sort of a bit of a disconnect between the readiness of the everyday members to hear a story of fallibility and a leadership who want to tightly guard the message. So, for instance, if you look at the race and the priesthood document itself, when you get to removing the restriction, there's all the way of languaging the explanations in which they use the passive. The curse of Cain was often put forward as justification or another explanation gained currency.
Mm.
And that to me is problematic because that just didn't happen. It didn't occur out of the blue. These were people saying things about other people. And so I think it's a bit Weasley to be in, you know, look, you know, this is not to suggest that there are people who haven't done a tremendous amount of work and provided wonderful, wonderful guidance. But I think perhaps these same people are caught between the kind of honesty that's necessary and the forthrightness and transparency that's necessary to finally put this to bed, or to actually get on the road to reconciliation and some kind of healing, and the strictures and the tensions around the church leaders and brethren who want to guard the integrity or the image of the church in the public sphere. Yeah, so in terms of the document, there is a way in which, you know, it's structured to say, okay, the church is this, then the church, then history, this happened in history, and this happened in the US context, and then the church changed, and now this is where we are as a church. I think that's all wonderful, but there are glaring gaps, just massive gaps in this whole accounting. And I feel that there is an appetite for people to have more explanation. One of the things I wrote in my blog post is, and this has come up on several occasions, and I have somebody, a friend of mine, who's Indian, Ganesh Cherian, he wrote He said, after pondering this admission for a couple of days, I find myself both jubilant and harrowed. On the one hand, excited that we could admit to fallibilities, and on the other hand, a crippling realization that we cannot trust what we are told.
Yeah.
So.
So, glaring gaps, are they covered to some degree by the links and the videos and the other pieces there? So here we have a statement. It printed out about six pages for me once I, you know, when you include all the footnotes, the endnotes and things like that. So we have that statement. When you say that there's a whole lot missing here, you know, when they point to Ed Kimball's article, they even point to you, Margaret, something you wrote on Jane Manning James. I know that there's these videos and these accompanying things alongside this. Are those gaps there, Gina? Are they gaps that really should be in the document itself? Or if somebody is interested, can at least the church have guided them?
Well, I think in terms of the historical references, is Leonard Bush's article in there?
No, it's not. So that's a big gap to me too. It is mentioned in Ed Kimball's article, and specifically it's so interesting in Ed Kimball's article. Just as a quick sidebar, Mark E. Peterson, Boyd K. Packer, and Elder McConkie, who are traditionally thought of as some of the worst offenders, you know, in these things, they kind of play these interesting roles. And one of them, if I remember right from the Kimball article, is Mark E. Peterson sending President Kimball Lester Bush's article. So interesting. And McConkie, as one of the people that did a study for the president, and says, yeah, there's no scriptural justification that would prevent us from making this change. And then Boyd K. Packer is being one of the big champions of making this change. So it's very, very interesting there. But you're right, Lester Bush is missing. I've kind of sidebarred there. But go back. So what are these gaps that you're talking about here? What really had to be? What was the historical event or the mindset that just wasn't touched?
I think when I'm thinking about gaps, I'm thinking about what you language or how you language something and put it into the public sphere. And there's always somebody or some party or within that who are privileged. And as far as I can tell, you know, this was something that was done to people. And so you can take one of a number of strategies here. You say, okay, I privilege the institution in this accounting, or I privilege those who are hurt in this accounting. And for me, it privileges the institution. It does a very nice tidy up, and it doesn't implicate them.
Yeah. Yeah. So leaving aside the apology part of it, there still is absolutely very little in this that would say this happened to people.
Exactly. I mean, we're the voices of black folk who experience this.
Right.
But what we have quotes from other people, Brigham Young and, various other people, Gordon B. Hinckley. It's not rounded out until we actually have the voices of those who've actually suffered through this.
Right. And that we have Elijah Abel and Jane James. Those are significant voices.
Yeah. What about people who are living today?
I think that responsibility falls on us. Institutions are always going to defend themselves. I think that we call it humanitarian efforts because it's human to human. And so I think that as we get the message out of for people whose hearts are tainted by prejudice, who have felt themselves justified in prejudice because of past teachings, to help them repent. But it's not complete until we do the Christ-like action that this statement demands. That I, of course, have spent a good many years telling stories of individual Black members, those who are living today, those who lived in the past. Their lives are singular and blessed to me. And that's what I do a lot in my life, is going around and telling those stories, including the painful story of Jane Manning James. Painful but glorious. Jane ended her life. She wrote a life story and ended it bearing her testimony. That was clearly what she wanted to convey. But we also have her letters, which are alluded to in the statement. But, you know, this is I don't know how many drafts there were, how long each draft was, But Jane's letters are poignant, where she, the first one that she writes to John Taylor says, "Dear brother, I called on your house last Thursday to have conversation with you concerning my future salvation. I realize my race and color and cannot expect my endowment as others who are white. Still, inasmuch as this is the fullness of times, and through Abraham, all mankind may be blessed, is there no blessing for me?" To me, first of all, it's heart-wrenching to hear Jane's words. She would get some blessing. She was allowed to do proxy baptisms in the temple. But the other part, it shows me clearly that Jane understood the doctrinal foundation for her petition. She understood that this is the last dispensation. All blessings are supposed to be available to all mankind. And she puts it in the letter. And even though she says, "I know that I can't expect my endowment as others who are white, she goes on and petitions for her endowment. Later asks if she can have it, and her ex-husband, who has returned at the end of his life. This is a bold and marvelous woman. When we've done productions of I Am Jane, her life has been a little controversial because we've told the whole story. We've gone into those letters. Our actresses who portrayed Jane have read those letters. Linda King Newell, who did the proxy temple work for Jane James, saw the play and was just brought to tears hearing a black woman recite Jane's own words. To me, that's my responsibility as a writer. I understand the church as an institution defending itself. I don't expect the church or even historians, whatever scholars there were, and clearly they were scholars because the historical facts are right, whatever they bring to it, you know the difference between a theater piece that you go to and Mormon History Association. You have academic papers. This is an academic paper. It's not expected to be anything but what it is. Whereas when I do my work as a writer, I fully anticipate that I will present people to the whole world and that they will use their empathetic imagination to feel what this person went through. I don't expect a church website to do what I am called to do as a writer.
So Gina, given that Margaret says what she said, can you see a way to the church to throw more of that into the official statement though? So you're probably not 100% persuaded by that?
Not really. Only because I think, people argue that the institution, of course, will defend itself. But when we talk about the church, are we not the church? And I would expect, we as, a congregation, are we not the church? When we talk about the church defending itself, are we talking about the brethren defending themselves? Are we talking about Salt Lake City, American Mormons, are they defending themselves? And it kind of leaves me with the question, all right, okay, let's just go with that. Let's say, okay, these historical accounts of Black Mormons are really a personal history, and they are such a poignant history and an important, history. But we're kind of left with this, I'm reading this, and there are other issues. I'm not black, but there are other issues about the curse theories and the valiancy and variations on valiance in the pre-existence that actually kind of filtered down to those of color. And I'm reading this, I just feel, as Ganesh did, jubilant, but really disappointed. And am I now doing something wrong because I'm not jubilant? That's kind of my question. And I know that there are a number of people, of color who are reading this and going, great, but not enough. Now, are we reading this in the wrong way? Should we just be kind of like have our party hats on? Which makes me feel really bad, like, hell, I have to repent again.
Yeah. Well, Gina, it sounds to me you gave a sacrament meeting talk about this issue, not about the statement because it hadn't come out yet. But clearly this is an issue that is deep in your heart. And I use heart on purpose because it's not, you didn't give an academic paper in sacrament meeting. I kind of did. Pardon me?
I kind of did. I was accused of giving an academic paper.
Then I used the wrong word. Those of us I believe that there is a worldwide connection of people who are called to bring greater unity within the Mormon Church as well as in the whole world. that to equalize things economically, to take care for the poor, to do what the Savior would do. And I think you make a very good call in talking about a statement that seems American, because certainly those who most need are what we have access to, we here in America, and I think you even in New Zealand, is most strongly needed where there are most of African lineage in the African continent itself. But the fact that you gave a sacrament meeting talk about this means that you reached a lot of people, you know, no matter if they felt it was academic, and it was good enough that your state president was concerned. Good for you. that you ruffled some New Zealand feathers.
And you wrote a blog post about it too. Kiwi Mormon's a decent sized blog, isn't it, Gina?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's on Patheon.
So. Yeah, yeah. So I don't know. Did you include the whole text of the article or of the talk, or just you kind of described it?
I just described it. Yeah,
yeah. So she's right that it did have some impact. Well, Gina, what's on the website here, at least, off to the right are all these different links. And one of the links is Members Speak About Diversity, Unity, and the Priesthood. And there's about 8 videos. The Context of History, A New Day, God's Children in Every Aspect, We Come Together and Unite as One, The Welcome Table, Diversity is Good, Roll Up Our Sleeves, A Person and a Sister, which are mostly black voices speaking there about it. And so you kind of said, they mentioned Elijah Abel and Jane Mammy James, but these things are there. Is that somehow secondary to you because it's the video presentation versus the actual statement? Again, I'm just trying to give as complete a sense here of your critique. Are you happy for these videos here? Do they feel like puff pieces to you? In other words, for it to really count for you, you would want more of this, here was my experience as a member of the church when I was excluded. Do you want that in the document itself?
Oh, heck yeah. I think there are so many complexities with this. With the question of race and Mormonism, that some of it is in the blind spot. Yes, I mean, I don't want to denigrate these, these videos as puff pieces, and I think they serve a purpose. But until we actually go deeply into the lived experience of these competing discourses, which on the one hand say I'm a child of God, and on the other hand, you know, draw on one's skin color as, you know, to explain one's positionality within, you know, this kind of the godly order of things. I think until we actually engage with the affect and the emotion, and now the emotion of actually having to reimagine that and rethink that, and that quick, you know, so many questions now arise over one's relationship with the church. So, you know, on the one hand, you've got a relationship with problems over the relationship with God and self, and now there are problems over the relationship with the church. What does this all mean?
Yeah, you cover that towards the end of your blog post about what does it mean if the leaders were wrong here? What else are they going to be wrong of? Can we do that? So I agree; these are all important points. I guess I'm kind of just a little bit like, okay, you know. I tend to not, when I'm online, I don't want to read something that's more than a dozen paragraphs. You know, so I'm just wondering, you know, what could have been in this document besides the document itself and links to different things that really would have been the right sweet spot of length. It sounds like you were looking for a 45-page article in order to really be satisfied here. Is that, am I being too rude to you?
Yeah, that's so rude, Dan.
Well, who knows? There may have been a longer version of the article, but
yeah.
This is the version that they want to retain their audience that they put on LDS.org.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's where I guess I'm... Okay, how many of you guys see this as a discussion starter versus, like, do you think that this is just a one-and-done kind of thing? What would you hope is next?
I think there will be more.
I agree. I think there will be more. I hope there's more. My biggest hope is just to talk more about what racism actually is. I think there's this idea that racism is just a few hurtful words. And so you get this kind of the idea that of reverse racism. So I hope this opens up a dialogue on microaggressions, overt racism versus benevolent racism. And talking more about just celebrating more cultures. I think there was one video that was included on the side that that talks about promoting race and ethnicity of different people within the church. So that's kind of what I'm hoping for.
Okay, but do you think it's coming? I mean, so would the next step be a letter to bishops and stake presidents, please read these over the pulpits? Would that be ideal? Is it general conference addresses that you guys are hoping? You're talking about wider discussion here, Janan. What specifically, though, in the church's sort of structure can we at least hope for next?
I think the next step should be to read this over the pulpit. I agree with Margaret, just reaching out to people, talking about this, promoting this publication, is the next step.
Gina, what would you hope is next now? And go ahead and lead us into the discussion of an apology, if you'd like.
All of the above. This was declared as a doctrine. And in every other case, if there's a doctrinal, a massive doctrinal change, as in polygamy, you know, there were statements read. So, yes, I think that needs to be over the pulpit in general conference. I think that they need to provide addendum materials for the curriculum materials to surface this and highlight it.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.